A man could become, for a while at least, any other person, and could take part in any conceivable adventure, real or imaginary. And when the program was over, he would have acquired a memory as vivid as any experience in his actual life, indeed indistinguishable from reality itself. Too freaking true. The first acid test ended up more like one of the old acid parties at La Honda, which is to say, a private affair, and mostly formless. It was meant to be public, but the pranksters were not the world's greatest at the mechanics of things like hiring a hall. The first one was going to be in Santa Cruz, but they couldn't hire a hall in time. They had to hold it out at Babb's house, a place known as The Spread, just outside of Santa Cruz in a community known as Soquel. The Spread was like a run-down chicken farm. The wild vetch and dodder vines were gaining ground every minute, at least where the ground wasn't burnt off or beaten down into a clay muck. There were fat brown dogs and broken vehicles and rusted machines and rotting troughs and recapped tires and a little old farmhouse with linoleum floors and the kind of old, greasy, easy chairs that upholstery flies hover over in nappy clouds and move off about 3/4 of an inch when you wave your hand at them. But there were also wild day-glow creations on the walls and ceilings by Babs, and the place was private and tucked off by itself. In any case, they were stuck with the Spread. About all the advertising they could do was confined to the day of the test itself. Norman Hartwig had painted a sign on some cardboard and tacked it onto some boards Babs had used as cue signs in the movie, and put it up in the hip pocket bookstore. Can you pass the acid test? The hip pocket bookstore was a paperback bookstore that Hassler and Peter Demma, one of the prankster outer circle, were running in Santa Cruz. They left word in the store that afternoon that it was going to be at Babs. A few local bohos saw it and came out, but mainly it was the pranksters and their friends who showed up at the Spread that night, including a lot of the Berkeley crowd that had been coming to La Honda, plus Allen Ginsberg and his entourage. It started off as a party, with some of the movie flashed on the walls, and lights, and tapes, and the pranksters providing the music themselves, not to mention the LSD. The pranksters' strange atonal Chinese music broadcast on all frequencies a la John Cage. It was mostly just another La Honda party. But then, around 3 a.m., a thing happened. The non-involved people, the people just there for the Beano, the people who hadn't seen the management like the Berkeley people, they had all left by 3 a.m., and the test was down to some kind of core. It ended up with Kesey on one side of Babs' living room and Ginsberg on the other, with everybody else arranged around these two poles like on a magnet, all the Kesey people over toward him and all the Ginsberg people toward him, the Super West and the Super East. And the subject got to be Vietnam. Kesey gives his theory of whole multitudes of people joining hands in a clump and walking away from the war. Ginsberg said all these things, these wars, were the result of misunderstandings. Nobody who was doing the fighting ever wanted to be doing it, and if everybody could only sit around in a friendly way and talk it out, they could get to the root of their misunderstanding and settle it. And then from the rear of the Kesey contingent came the voice of the only man in the room who had been within 1,000 miles of the war, Babs, saying, "Yes, it's all so very obvious. It's all so very obvious." How magical that comment seemed at that moment. The magical eighth hour of acid, how clear it all now was. Ginsberg had said it, and Babs the warrior had certified it, and it had all built to this, and suddenly everything was so very clear. The acid test at the Spread was just a dry run, of course. It didn't really reach out into the world. But soon, the Rolling Stones, England's second hottest pop group, were coming to San Jose, 40 miles south of San Francisco, for a show in the Civic Auditorium on December 4th. Kesey can see it all, having seen it before. He can see all the wound-up, wired-up teeny freaks and assorted multitudes pouring out of the Cow Palace after the Beatles show that night, the fragmented pink-tentacled beast pouring out still a-quiver with ecstasy and jelly beans, all cocked and aimless with no flow to go off in. It is so very obvious. For 3 or 4 days, the pranksters searched for a hall in San Jose and couldn't come up with one, naturally. It really seemed natural and almost right that nothing should be definite until the last minute. All that was certain was that they would find one at the last minute. The movie would create that much, at least. And what if the multitudes didn't know where it was going to be until the last minute? Well, those who were meant to be there, those who were in the pudding, they would get there. You were either on the bus or off the bus, and that went for the whole world, even in San Jose, California. At the last minute, Kesey talked a local boho figure known as Big Nig into letting them use his old hulk of a house. Kesey had hooked up with a rock and roll band, the Grateful Dead, led by Jerry Garcia, the same dead-end kid who used to live in the chateau in Palo Alto with Paige Browning and other seeming no-counts, lumpen beatniks, and you had to throw them out when they came over and tried to crash the parties on Perry Lane. Garcia remembered. Now they came down and used to get booted out by Kesey and the wine drinkers. The wine drinkers, the middle-class bohemians of Perry Lane. They both, Kesey and Garcia, had been heading into the pudding from different directions all that time. And now Garcia was a, yes, beautiful person, quiet, into the pudding, and a great guitar player. Garcia had first named his group the Warlocks, meaning sorcerers or wizards. And they had been eking by playing for the beer drinkers at jazz joints and the like around Palo Alto. To the Warlocks, the beer drinker music, even when called jazz, was just square hip. They were on to that distinction, too. For Kesey, they could just play, do their thing. The Dead had an organist called Pigpen, who had a Hammond electric organ, and they moved the electric organ into Big Nig's ancient house, plus all of the Grateful Dead's electrified guitars and basses, and the Prankster's electrified guitars and basses and flutes and horns, and the light machines and the movie projectors and the tapes and mics and hi-fis, all of which pile up in insane coils of wires and gleams of stainless steel and winking amplifier dials before Big Nig's unbelieving eyes. His house is old and has wiring that would hardly hold a toaster. The Pranksters are primed in full Prankster regalia. Paul Foster has on his importancy coat and now has a huge head of curly hair, a great curly mustache pulling back into great curly mutton chops roaring off his face. Paige Browning is the king of face painters. He becomes a full-fledged devil with a bright orange face, and his eyes become the centers of two great silver stars painted over the orange, and his hair is silver with silver dust, and he paints his lips silver with silver lipstick. This very night the Pranksters all sit down with oil pastel crayons and colored pens, and at a wild rate start printing handbills on 8.5 by 11 paper saying, "Can you pass the acid test?" and giving Big Nig's address. As the jelly bean cocked masses start pouring out of the Rolling Stones concert at the Civic Auditorium, the Pranksters charge in among them. Orange and silver devil, wild man in a coat of buttons, Pranksters, Pranksters, handing out the handbills with the challenge, like some sort of demons, warlocks verily, come to channel the wild, pointless energy built up by the Rolling Stones inside. They come piling into Big Nig's, and suddenly acid and the world craze were everywhere, the electric organ vibrating through every belly in the place, kids dancing not rock dances, not the frug and the, what, swim mother, but dancing ecstasy, leaping, dervishing, throwing their hands over their heads like Daddy Grace's own stroked-out inner courtiers. Yes, Roy Seaburn's lights washing past every head, Cassidy rapping, Paul Foster handing people weird little things out of his eccentric bag, old whistles, tin crickets, burnt keys, spectral plastic handles. Everybody's eyes turn on like light bulbs, fuses blow, blackness, wow, the things that shake and vibrate and funnel and freak out in this blackness. And then somebody slaps new fuses in and the old hulk of a house shudders back, the wiring writhing and fragmenting like molting snakes. The organs vibromassage the belly again, fuses blow, minds scream, heads explode. Neighbors call the cops. 200, 300, 400 people from out there drawn into the movie. Into the edge of the pudding, at least. A mass closer and higher than any mass in history, it seems, most surely. And Kesey makes minute adjustment. Small toggle switch here. Lubricated with Vaseline number 634-3, diluted with carbon tetrachloride. And they ripple, Major. Ripple, but with meaning. 400 of the attuned multitude headed toward the pudding, the first mass acid experience, the dawn of the psychedelic, the flower generation and all the rest of it, and Big Nig wants the rent. How you holding? How you holding? I mean, like you know, says Big Nig to Garcia. I didn't charge Garcia nothing to use this place, like free, you know. And the procedure now is that every cat here contributes, man, to help out with the rent. With the rent. Yeah, I mean, like, says Big Nig. Big Nig stares at Garcia with the deepest look of hip-spade soul authority you can imagine, and nice and officious, too. Yeah, I mean, like, Garcia, for his part, however, doesn't know which bursts out first, the music or the orange laugh. Out the edges of his eyes, he can see his own black hair framing his face. It is so long, to the shoulders, and springs out like a Sudanese soldier's. And then Big Nig's big, earnest black face right in front of him flapping and washing comically out into the glistening, acid-glee red sea of faces out beyond them both in the galactic red lakes on the walls. Yeah, I mean, like, for the rent, man, says Big Nig, you already blown 6 fuses. Blown. 6 fuses. Garcia sticks his hand into his electric guitar, and the notes come out like a huge orange laugh, all blown fuses, electric spark leaps in colors upon the glistening sea of faces. It's a freaking laugh and a half. A new star is being born, like a light bulb in a womb, and Big Nig wants the rent. A new star being born, a new planet forming, Ahura Mazda blazing in the world womb, here before our very eyes. And Big Nig, the poor pathetic spade, wants his rent. A freaking odd thought, that one. A big funky spade looking pathetic and square. For 20 years in the hip life, Negroes never even looked square. They were the archetypical soul figures. But what is soul, or funky, or cool, or baby, in the new world of the ecstasy, the all-one, the Kairos? If only there were the perfect place, which would be a place big enough for the multitudes and isolated enough to avoid the cops, with their curfews and eternal hassling. Shortly after that, they found the perfect place, by accident. By accident, Mahavira? The third acid test was scheduled for Stinson Beach, 15 miles north of San Francisco. Stinson Beach was already a gathering place for local heads. You could live all winter in little beach cottages there for next to nothing. There was a nice solid brick recreation hall on the beach, all very nice. But at the last minute that whole deal fell through, and they shifted to Muir Beach, a few miles south. The handbills were already out, all over the head sections of San Francisco. Can you pass the acid test? Advertising Cassidy and Ann Murphy Vaudeville and celebrities who might be there, which included anybody who happened to be in town, or might make it to town, the Fugs, Ginsburg, Roland Kirk. There were always some nice chiffon subjunctives and the future conditionals in the prankster handbill rhetoric, but who was to deny who might be drawn into the movie? Anyway, at the last minute, they headed for Muir Beach instead. The fact that many people wouldn't know about the change and would go to Stinson Beach and merely freeze in the darkness and never find the right place, somehow that didn't even seem distressing. It was part of some strange analogical order of the universe. Norman Hartwegg hooked down his LSD. It was in the acid gas capsules that night. And thought of Gurdjieff. Gurdjieff wouldn't announce a meeting until the last minute. We're going to get together tonight. The people that got there, got there. And there was a message in that alone, which was, of course, you're either on the bus or off the bus. Those who were on the bus, even if they weren't pranksters like Marshall Efron, the round Mercury of hip California, or the Hell's Angels, all found it. The cops, however, never did. They were apparently thrown off by the Stinson Beach handbills. Muir Beach had a big log cabin-style lodge for dances, banquets, and the like. The lodge was stilted up out in a waste of frigid marsh grass. A big empty nighttime beach in winter. Some little log tourist cabins with blue doors on either side, all empty. The lodge had 3 big rooms and was about 100 feet long, all logs and rafters and exposed beams. A tight ship of dark wood and roughing it. The Grateful Dead piled in with their equipment and the pranksters with theirs, which now included a Hammond electric organ for Gretsch and a great strobe light. The strobe. The strobe, or stroboscope, was originally an instrument for studying motion, like the way a man's legs move when he is running. In a darkened chamber, for example, you aim a bright light, flashing on and off at the runner's legs as he runs. The light flashes on and off very rapidly, maybe 3 times as fast as a normal heartbeat. Every time the light flashes on, you see a new stage in the movement of the runner's legs. The successive images tend to freeze in your mind because the light flashes off before the usual optical blur of the motion can hit you. The strobe has certain magical properties in the world of the acid heads. At certain speeds, stroboscopic lights are so synced in with the pattern of brain waves that they can throw epileptics into a seizure. Heads discovered that strobes could project them into many of the sensations of an LSD experience without taking LSD. The strobe. To people standing under the mighty strobe, everything seemed to fragment. Ecstatic dancers, their hands flew off their arms, frozen in the air. Their glistening faces came apart. A gleaming ellipse of teeth here. A pair of buffered, high-lit cheekbones there. All flacking and fragmenting into images as in an old flicker movie. A man in slices. All of history pinned up on a butterfly board. The experience, of course. The strobe, the projectors, the mics, the tapes, the amplifiers, the variable lag ampex. It was all set up in a coiling, gleaming clump in the Lincoln Log Lodge. The communal clump. Babs working over the dials, talking into the microphones to test them. Heads beginning to pour in. Marshall Efren and Norman. Norman already fairly zonked. Then in comes Kesey through the main door. Everyone watches. His face is set, his head cocked slightly. He is going to do something. Everyone watches because this seems terribly important. Drawn in right away by the charismatic vacuum cleaner they are. Kesey heads for the control center, saying nothing to anyone, reaches into the galaxy of dials, makes a single minute adjustment. Yes, one toggle switch, double pull, single throw, double break in the allegory of control. Babs is there, bombed, but setting up the intricate glistening coils of the tapes and projectors and the rest of it. Each of the pranksters, bombed, has some fairly exacting task to do. Norman is staring at the dials, and he can't even see the numbers, he is so bombed. The numbers are wriggling off like huge luminous parasites under a microscope, but function under acid. Bab says, one reason we're doing this is to learn how to function on acid. Of course. Prepare for the day when multitudes, millions, civilizations are on acid, seeking Satori. It is coming. The wave is spreading. The heads are all sitting around on the floor, about 300 of them. Into the maelstrom. Yes. At Big Nig's in San Jose, a lot of the kids the pranksters had corralled coming out of the Rolling Stones show did not take LSD that night, although there were enough heads at Big Nig's, stoned on various things, to create that sympathetic vibration known as the contact high. But this is different. Practically everybody who has found the place after the switch from Stinson Beach is far enough into the thing to know what the acid in the acid test means. A high percentage took LSD about 4 hours ago, wrote out the first rush, and are ready now to groove. The two projectors shine forth with the movie. The bus and the pranksters start rolling over the walls of the lodge, Babs and Kesey rapping on about it, the bus lumping huge and vibrating and bouncing in great swells of heads and color. Norman, zonked, sitting on the floor, is half frightened, half ecstatic, although something in the back of his mind recognizes this as his acid test pattern, to sit back and watch, holding on through the rush until 3 or 4 a.m. in the magic hours, and then dance. But so much of a rush this time. The movie and Roy Seaburn's light machine pitching the intergalactic red science fiction seas to all corners of the lodge, oil and water and food coloring pressed between plates of glass, and projected in vast size, so that the very ooze of cellular creation seems to ectoplast into the ethers. And then the dead coming in with their immense submarine vibrato vibrating, garanging, from the Aleutian Rocks to the Baja Griffin cliffs of the Gulf of California. The dead's weird sound, agony in ecstasis. Submarine somehow, turbid half the time, tremendously loud but like sitting under a waterfall, at the same time full of sort of ghoul show vibrato sounds, as if each string on their electric guitars is half a block long, and twanging in a room full of natural gas, not to mention their great Hammond electric organ, which sounds like a movie house Wurlitzer, a diathermy machine, a citizen's band radio, and an auto-grind garbage truck at 4 a.m., all coming over the same frequency. Then suddenly another movie, The Frogman. Babs and Gretch and Hagen made it down in Santa Cruz. The story of Babs the Frogman, arising from the Pacific in black neoprene frogman suit from flippers to insect goggles, the pranking monster, falling in love with the princess, Gretch, with floods of frames from elsewhere. The bus movie? Brittering in stroboscopically, Frogman woos her and wins her and loses her to the Pacific Chohans in submarinal projection. Babs. Gretch. Norman has never seen a movie while under acid before, and it deepens, deepens, deepens in perspective, this movie, the most 3D movie ever made, until they are standing right before him, their very neoprene fairy tales, and the Pacific is so far in the distance and black out beyond the marshes around the Muir Beach Lodge, until Babs and Gretch are now in the room in the flesh in two separate spots, here before me on the beach, and over here in this very room, in this very lodge on the beach. Babs at the microphone, and Gretch nearby at the new Hammond organ. Such sync, that they should narrate and orchestrate their own lives like this, in variable lag, layer upon layer of variable lags. Heee! Into the whirlpool, who should appear but Owsley? Owsley, done up in his $600 head costume, has emerged from his subterrane of espionage and paranoia, to come see the prankster experiment for himself. And in the middle of the giddy contagion, he takes LSD. They never saw him take it before. He takes the LSD and... roil! The whirlpool picks him up and spins him down into the stroboscopic stereoptic prankster panopticon in full variable lag. Such creatures. Hell's angels come reeling in, shrieking day-glow, then clumping together on the floor under the black light, and then most gentle Buddha, blissly passing around among themselves various glittering angel esoterica. Chains, iron crosses, knives, buttons, coins, keys, wrenches, spark plugs, rocking over these arcana, winking in the day glow. Orange and silver devil gliding through the dancers, grinning his zealot grin in every face, and Keezy crouched amid the gleaming coils at the controls. Keezy looks out upon the stroboscopic whirlpool, the dancers, flung and flinging in ecstasy, gyrating, levitating, men in slices, in ping-pong balls, in the creamy bare essence, and it reaches a sink he never saw before. Heads from all over the acid world out here and all whirling into the pudding. Now let a man see what control is. Keezy mans the strobe and a twist of the mercury lever up, and they all speed up. Now the whole whirlpool, so far into it they are. Faster they dance, hands thrown up off their arms like confetti in the strobe flashing, blissful faces falling apart and being exchanged, for I am you and you are me in Cosmos Tasmanian deviltry. Turn it down, and they slow down. Or we turn down, it, Cosmo, turns down, still in perfect sync, one brain, one energy, a single flow of intersubjectivity. It is possible, this alchemy so dreamed of by all the heads, it is happening before him. Control. Curiously, after the first rush at the acid test, there would be long intervals of the most exquisite boredom. Exquisite because it was so unsuspected after the general frenzy. Nothing would happen, at least not in the usual sense. Those who were not on the bus would come to the realization that there was no schedule. The Grateful Dead did not play in sets. No eight numbers to a set, then a 25-minute break, and so on, four or five sets, and then the closeout. The Dead might play one number for 5 minutes or 30 minutes. Who kept time? Who could keep time with history cut up in slices? The Dead could get just as stoned as anyone else. The non-attuned would look about, and here would be all manner of heads, including those running the show, the pranksters, stroked out against the walls like slices of jello. Waiting, with nobody looking very likely to start it back up. Those who didn't care to wait would tend to drift off, stoned or otherwise, and the test would settle down to the pudding. The prankster band started the strange Chinese cacophony of its own, with Gretch wailing on the new electric organ. Norman got up and danced, it being that time. He even fooled about a bit with a little light projection thing of his own, although he didn't think he was good enough, but the magic hours were coming on like electric velvet. Keezy spoke softly over the microphone. They were into the still eye of the hurricane, the pudding. At dawn, a freaking cold light on the marsh grass and the beach. A purple shadow all over the ocean like one huge stone-cold bruise. Suddenly the main door bursts open and it's Owsley. Owsley is lurching and groping and screaming, "Survival!" It comes out like a steam whistle forced out of a constricted little opening. Survival! Owsley, the acid king in his $600 head outfit, groping through the blue-bruised dawn with his eyes like disaster craters, hissing, Survival! The sight of Kesey apparently hits him with a surge of adrenaline, however, because he recovers his voice and starts in on Kesey. Kesey! The gist of it is that Kesey can't do this again. This is the end. The acid tests are over. Kesey is a maniac, and the tests are maniacal, and the roof is falling in. Taking LSD in a monster group like this gets too many forces going, too much amok energy, causing very freaky and destructive things to happen, and so on. It's his acid, and he says this is the end. None of them can figure out precisely what he is saying, just that he has flipped and Kesey did it. Little by little, they piece it together. He has had quite a trip for himself on his own LSD, has Owsley. It seems that Owsley took the LSD, a good dose apparently, and the strobe light and the incredible layers of variable lag began rocking and rippling him, and it threw him into a time warp, or parallel time dimension. The heads were always talking about such things. They could cite some serious thinkers, scientists even, such as C.D. Broad and his theory of a second temporal dimension. Events, which are separated by a temporal gap in one dimension, may be adjoined without any gap in the other, just as two points in the Earth's surface, which differ in longitude, may be identical in latitude, or J.W. Dunn's theory of serialism or infinite regress, or Maurice Maeterlinck. The heads were always talking about such things, and Owsley was primed for it. Then he got high. Then he got caught in the whirlpool, spun out of his gourd by all the special effects of the prankster's variable lag devices, and the legend of the trip he took eventually was told as follows. Back he went into the 18th century, Count Cagliostro. No longer plain Giuseppe Balsamo of Palermo, the Oakland of the Mediterranean, but the good count, alchemist, seer, magician, master of precognition, forecaster of lotteries, alchemical creator. From out of base elements of this diamond, greatest and most dazzling in history, here Cardinal Louis de Rohan, but persecuted as a thaumaturge, thrust into this spinning black dungeon, the Bastille, seeping with lurid water and carbonated moss and twitching dismembered rats, anatomized in the flashing light of the diamond they wouldn't believe, a rat shank here, a rat metacarpal there, rat teeth, rat eyes, rat tails leaping and frozen in the air like city lights, that noise, a mob in the streets, either salvation or the Bastille begins to disintegrate into absorbent felt cubes, and so on. The world began fragmenting on him. It began coming totally to pieces, breaking up into component parts, and he wasn't even back in the 20th century yet. He was trapped. Where? Paris in 1786? The whole world was coming to pieces molecule by molecule now, and swimming like grease bubbles in a cup of coffee, disappearing into the intergalactic ooze and gases all around, including his own body. He lost his skin, his skeleton, his pulmonary veins, sneaking out into the ooze like eels they are, reeking phosphorus, his neural ganglia, unraveling like hot worms and wiggling down the galactic drain, his whole substance dissolving into gaseous nothingness until finally he was down to one cell. One human cell. His. That was all that was left of the entire known world, and if he lost control of that one cell, there would be nothing left. The world would be, like, over. He has to rebuild himself and the entire world from that one cell with a gigantic act of will. Too overwhelming. Where does a man start? With California Route 1 so he can get out of here in his car? Or will it turn out to be merely the filthy Rue Ventroux with the Bastille mobs waiting? Or start with the car? The differential? How did they make the bastards? Or the beach? All those freaking grains of sand? The marsh grass? The tourist cabins? Got to put every blue door back? Or the ocean? Or leave it dry? Save making all those filthy, blind, bathysphere black animals down there. Or the sky. How far does it go? The Big Dipper? The Ursa Minor? The Delphinium? Suppose it is really infinite concentric spheres of crystal making infinite gelatinous submarinal vibrations. The dead? The pranksters? Kesey? Kesey's out for good. Kesey and the bathysphere brutes. But with a superheroic effort he begins. But by the time he gets himself remade, it is too much. It is overwhelming. He makes his car. He makes the parking lot and the beginning of the road out. He'll make the rest of it as he goes along. Freak it, split, leave the rest of the known world to its own devices out in the gases. He jumped into a car and gunned off, and smashed it into a tree. A tree he hadn't even put back yet. But the crash somehow pops the whole world back. There it is, back from the fat, bubbling ooze. The car is smashed, but he has survived. Survived! Survival! And he plunges into the lodge to seek out the maniac, Kesey. That some bitch has probably popped back, too. Chapter 19. The Trips Festival. Owsley's Freakout. Owsley became obsessed with himself. Whenever the subject was the LSD experience, which it was most of the time around Owsley, he would recount his experience at Muir Beach. It seemed to horrify and intrigue him at the same time, such morbid but wonderful details. Everyone listens. Can such things be? In any case, it sounded like Owsley thought Kesey was a demon and he was going to cut off their LSD supply. Richard Alpert was also unhappy with the acid tests. Alpert, like Timothy Leary, had sacrificed his academic career as a psychologist for the sake of the psychedelic movement. It was hard enough to keep the straight multitudes from going hysterical over the subject of LSD, even in the best of circumstances, let alone when it was used for manic screaming orgies in public places. Among the heads who leaned toward Leary and Alpert, it was hard to even freaking believe that the pranksters were pulling a freaking prank like this. Any moment they were expecting them to explode into some sort of debacle, some sort of mass freakout that the press could seize on and bury the psychedelic movement forever. The police watched them closely, but there was very little they could do about it, except for an occasional marijuana bust, since there was no law against LSD at the time. The pranksters went on to hold tests in Palo Alto, Portland, Oregon, 2 in San Francisco, 4 in and around Los Angeles, and 3 in Mexico. And no laws broken here, Lieutenant. Only every law of God and man, in short a goddamn outrage, and we're powerless. The acid tests were one of those outrages, one of those scandals that create a new style or a new world view. Everyone clucks, fumes, grinds their teeth over the bad taste, the bad morals, the insolence, the vulgarity, the childishness, the lunacy, the cruelty, the irresponsibility, the fraudulence, and in fact gets worked up into such a state of excitement, such an epitasis, such a slaver they can't turn it loose. It becomes a perfect obsession. And now they'll show you how it should have been done. The acid tests were the epic of the psychedelic style and practically everything that has gone into it. I don't mean merely that the pranksters did it first, but rather that it all came straight out of the acid tests in a direct line leading to the Trips Festival of January 1966. That brought the whole thing full out in the open. Mixed media entertainment. This came straight out of the acid tests combination of light and movie projections, strobes, tapes, rock and roll, black light. Acid rock, the sound of the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper album, and the high vibrato electronic sounds of the Jefferson Airplane, the Mothers of Invention, and many other groups. The mothers of it all were the Grateful Dead at the acid tests. The dead were the audio counterpart of Roy Seaburn's light projections. Owsley was responsible for some of this indirectly. Owsley had snapped back from his great freakout and started pouring money into the Grateful Dead and thereby the tests. Maybe he figured the tests were the wave of the future, whether he had freaked out or not. Maybe he thought acid rock was the sound of the future, and he would become a kind of Brian Epstein for the Grateful Dead. I don't know. In any case, he started buying the Dead equipment such as no rock and roll band ever had before, the Beatles included, all manner of tuners, amplifiers, receivers, loudspeakers, microphones, cartridges, tapes, theater horns, booms, lights, turntables, instruments, mixers, muters, serval mesochroics, whatever was on the market. The sound went down so many microphones and hooked through so many mixers and variable lags and blew up in so many amplifiers and roiled around in so many speakers and fed back down so many microphones, it came on like a chemical refinery. There was something wholly new and deliriously weird in the Dead sound, and practically everything new in rock and roll, rock jazz I have heard it called, came out of it. Even details like psychedelic poster art, the quasi-Art Nouveau swirls of lettering, design, and vibrating colors, electro-pastels and spectral day-glow came out of the acid tests. Later, other impresarios and performers would recreate the prankster styles with a sophistication the pranksters never dreamed of. Art is not eternal, boys. The posters became works of art in the accepted cultural tradition. Others would even play the Dead's sound more successfully, commercially, anyway, than the Dead. Others would do the mixed media thing until it was pure ambrosial candy for the brain with creamy filling every time. To which Kesey would say, "They know where it is, but they don't know what it is." It was actually Stuart Brand who thought up the Great Trips Festival of January 1966. Brand and a San Francisco artist, Ramon Sender. Brand was 27 and an ex-biologist who had run across the Indian peyote cults in Arizona and New Mexico. Brand founded an organization called America Needs Indians. And then one day he took some LSD right after an explorer's satellite went up to photograph the Earth. And as the old synapses began wrapping around inside his skull at 5,000 thoughts per second, he was struck with one of those questions that inflame men's brains. Why haven't we seen a photograph of the whole Earth yet? And he drove across America from Berkeley, California to 116th Street, New York City, selling buttons with that legend on them to leftists, rightists, fundamentalists, theosophists, malcontents, anyone with the health or stealth of paranoia or the put-on in their souls. He and his friend Sender got the idea of pulling together all the new forms of expression that were kicking around in the hip world at that moment and having a super acid test out in the open. Hire a hall and call in the multitudes. They found an impresario for the thing, Bill Graham, a New Yorker who had a lot of cachet in the hip world of San Francisco as a member of the San Francisco Mime Troupe, which used to get busted for putting on political dumb shows in the park, that kind of thing. The Trips Festival was set for Friday, Saturday, and Sunday nights, January 21st through the 23rd, at the Longshoremen's Hall in San Francisco. The Trips Festival was billed as a big celebration that was going to simulate an LSD experience, minus the LSD, using light effects and music mainly. The big night, Saturday night, was going to be called the Acid Test, featuring Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters. Kesey and the Pranksters were primed for the festival. Even Mountain Girl was on hand. She had wrestled the thing out in her mind and was back on the bus. The Pranksters had just held an acid test at the Fillmore Auditorium, a big ballroom in the middle of one of San Francisco's big Negro slums, the Fillmore District. It was a wild night. Hundreds of heads and bohos from all over the Bay Area turned out, zonked to the eyeballs. Paul Krasner was back in town, and he heard the word that was out on the scene. Everybody would be dropping acid about 5 or 6 p.m. to get ready for the acid test to begin that night at 9 o'clock at the Fillmore Auditorium. Krasner arrives and, shit, he sees a ballroom surrealistically seething with a couple of thousand bodies stoned out of their ever-loving Bruces in crazy costumes and obscene makeup with a raucous rock and roll band and stroboscopic lights and a thunder machine and balloons and beads and screamers and electronic equipment and the back of a guy's coat proclaiming, "Please don't believe in magic," to a girl dancing with 4-inch eyelashes so that even the goddamn Pinkerton guards were contact high. Kesey asks him to take the microphone and contribute to a running commentary on the scene. "All I know," he announces into the din, "is that if I were a cop and I came in here, I wouldn't know where to begin." Well, the cops came in and they didn't know where to begin. They came in to close the test down at 2 a.m. in keeping with a local ordinance, and the whole thing was at its maddest height. Mountain Girl had hold of a microphone and was shrieking encouragement to the flailing dancers. Babs was beaming spotlights at heads who were veering around, bombed, and asking them spectral questions over another microphone. "Say there, what's your trouble? Have you lost your mind?" Paige Browning was grinning zealot. The cops started shouting for them to close down, but couldn't make themselves heard and started pulling plugs out. Microphone plugs, loudspeaker plugs, strobe plugs, amplifier plugs. But there were so many goddamn plugs, the most monumental snake pit of wires and plugs in history, and as fast as they would pull 8 plugs out, Mountain Girl would put 10 plugs back in. And finally, Mountain Girl had a microphone up on the balcony somewhere and was screaming instructions to the dancers and the cops, louder music, more wine, and they couldn't find her. Finally, they ordered the pranksters to start clearing the place out, which they did, except for Babs, who sat down in a chair and wouldn't budge. We said, "Get busy," said the cops. "I don't have to," said Babs. "I'm the boss here. They're working for me." "Yeah?" And one of the cops grabs Babs by a luminous vest he has on, succeeding only in separating Babs from the vest. Babs grinning maniacally, but suddenly looming most large and fierce. "You're under arrest."
"For what?"
"Resisting."
"Resisting what?"
"You're going to come quietly, or do we have to take you?" "Either way you want it," says Babs, grinning in the most frightening manner now, like the next step is 8 karate chops to the gizzards and giblets. Suddenly it is a Mexican standoff, with both sides glaring, but nobody swinging a punch yet. It is a grand hassle, of course. At the last minute, a couple of Kesey's lawyers arrive on the scene and cool everything down and talk the cops out of it and Babs out of it, and it all rumbles away in the valley as part of the Velt hustle. The lawyers, yes. Kesey's original marijuana charge on the big arrest at La Honda had been ricocheting around in the San Mateo County court system for 9 months. Kesey's lawyers were attacking the warrant that enabled the various constables to make the raid. The case had started with a grand jury hearing, which is, of course, a secret procedure. The county claimed it had all sorts of evidence to the effect that Kesey and the pranksters had been giving dope to minors. Kesey's lawyers were trying to get the whole case thrown out on the grounds that the original warrant for the raid was fraudulent. This didn't work, and Kesey now had the choice of facing trial and a lot of lurid testimony, or waiving open trial and letting a judge decide the case on the basis of the transcript of the grand jury proceedings. It was finally arranged that Kesey would let the judge do it. He would most likely be getting a light sentence. Even after that, he could still appeal the case on the grounds that the warrant had been trumped up. This whole thing with the judge was the equivalent, in a roundabout way, of pleading no contest. On January 17, 1966, 4 days before the Trips Festival, the judge duly found Kesey guilty and sentenced him to 6 months on a work farm and 3 years on probation. That was about what his lawyers expected. It wasn't so bad. The work farm was right near La Honda, ironically enough, and the prisoners did a lot of their work clearing out a stretch of forest up back of Kesey's place. There was something very funny about that. Limelight bowers for the straight multitudes. There was more irony. McMurphy, in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, started his adventures with a 6-month stretch on a work farm. Kesey had been a McMurphy on the outside for 4 years. Now maybe he would be a McMurphy on the inside for real. Maybe. Anyway, it was far from the goddamn end of the world. Then an uncool thing happened. The night of January 19th, 2 nights before the Trips Festival, Kesey, Mountain Girl, and some of the pranksters went over to Stuart Brand's apartment in North Beach, San Francisco, to make plans for the Trips Festival. Sometime after midnight, Kesey and Mountain Girl went up on the roof on top of the building and spread out an old blue pad that had been in the back of somebody's station wagon on the gravel up there, and stretched out on the pad, grooving on the peaceful debris of North Beach. It's nice and homey, boho quaint, North Beach. Slums with a view. Out there, the lights of the bay and the fishing boats and the honky-tonks and more lights climbing up the hills of San Francisco, and nearer, all the asphalt squares of the other rooftops, squares and levels and ladders, grooving on the design, which is nice and peaceful and a little arty-looking, but that is North Beach. Mountain Girl, all dark brown hair and big brown eyes, coming on ornery and fun-loving, it occurs to Kesey, rather like the eyes of an Irish setter pup just turning from awkward, carefree frolic to the task of devotion. Mountain Girl is being enthusiastic about the Trips Festival. "With that big new speaker," she says, "we'll be able to wire that place so you can hear a flea fart." Awkward, carefree frolic to the task of... Kesey is feeling old. Once a stud so gorged with muscle tone, his face feels lopsided with the strain of... the eternal hassling, the lawyering, the legally sanctioned lying on all sides, politicking, sucking up, getting lectured at, cranking on the old lopsided diplomatic smile. "Hear a flea fart."
"Hasn't happened yet," says Kesey.
"With this many days to set it up? Always before we were in the hall that night and maybe set up before we finished in the morning."
And so forth and so on. Kesey and Mountain Girl lie on their stomachs with their chins in their hands, gazing down 4 stories to the alley below, and occasionally scraping gravel off the rooftop and tossing it down.